Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Hey, everybody. We have a vexing one today. Catherine Rampell from the Washington Post writes a great column on economics. Not vexing because Catherine is vexing. Far from it. She's one of the great columnists on economics. But it's vexing a little bit because we recorded this before, right before the Silicon Valley crash. But Catherine was nice enough to come back and talk about that. You'll hear that at the beginning, and then we're going to go to our conversation about a whole range of economic issues. I think you're going to not be vexed by this one, but enjoy it. Catherine Rampell from the Washington Post. What's the best way into this? Should we talk about what happened yesterday? The big banks putting billions in the help bill level banks or other banks?
I mean, what's been interesting is that the federal government took a bunch of extraordinary measures last weekend, in theory, to restore confidence and stop the panic and all of that.
And that's happened. It's restored confidence and stopped the panic, right?
Well,
so we're fine.
I mean, the depositors at Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank are totally fine.
Well, they're fine now. They're bailed out.
Yeah, they've don't call the B word. Nobody knows what.
Oh, no. All their deposits are secured.
Right.
That's what I meant.
Nobody knows what a bailout is. We just know it's bad. So those depositors are fine. There's some ambiguity about everybody else who has their money in a small or medium-sized bank if they have more than $250,000, which most people don't have. But there are enough people who do and enough people who are confused about what's insured and what isn't, even if they're below the FDIC insured cap, that you're still seeing this basically flight to safety where there's been an outflow of deposits from these small and medium-sized banks to the too big to fail banks, essentially.
And that makes those smaller banks and middle-sized banks weaker and these too big to fail banks stronger. And is that good? Is that good or bad for us?
I mean, it's good for the big banks, certainly. It's not good for the small and medium-sized banks.
And is that good for the economy?
To the extent that we're still seeing a lot of turmoil in financial markets, definitely not good for the economy. The challenge is that to really allay these concerns, I think the feds would have to say, look, no matter what size your bank account is, you will be made whole. Your money is not at risk of being affected by a bank run or otherwise. We are treating everything as if it is fully insured. The problem is that it's not technically legal for them to say that in such explicit terms because there is a law that says FDIC insurance is only for deposits under $250,000 and there has to be a special vote.
So they're guaranteeing this to whom? To people in every bank?
They're not doing this. They're not explicitly saying this. Right. They're saying much more vague things that are, you know, clearly within their legal ability to say, like, your money is safe. But if you are, not a financial expert, or even if you are, it's not clear what that means. And I think there's still some lingering anxiety.
So that's everybody. It's not clear to anybody.
Right,
okay.
Right. So I think there's still some lingering anxiety about what does that mean? Is it safe? Is it not safe? And then the other layer of all of this, which is that even if the deposits are safe, What about the people who own shares of stock in those banks? Because like in the case of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, they said, we are not protecting the shareholders. We are not protecting the bondholders or the executives or anybody else. We're only protecting the depositors. So you still might be worried if you own stock in First Republic Bank, for example, that you might get wiped out because that's how capitalism works.
Right, right. Which is good. I mean,
which is, in theory, capitalism
still to survive. And or, do we want to guarantee everything for everybody? And if they don't do that, are everyone going to go to these just big banks? And is that good? So what's the choice there?
There are trade-offs, right? In the near term, if you make a guarantee like that, that will probably stop the panic. Or not stop it, but at the very least, slow it down a little bit, that people will say, okay, I guess I don't really need to move my money from Oklahoma City Community Bank or whatever to JP Morgan or City or Bank of America.
Yeah, whatever.
Because the government has said everything's protected. In the short term, that's a good thing. In the long term, it's risky because if the government is implicitly or explicitly, I guess, guaranteeing that they will bail out every depositor in America, that means that the managers of those banks, let's say, might be, you know, a little more fast and loose with how financially responsible they are with their depositors' money.
In economics,
this is this term called moral hazard, that essentially if you tell people that there's no downside to their behavior or a capped downside to their behavior, then they do dumber, riskier things.
And raising the limit, is that like something they might do? And again, you're talking about the law is up to 250, right?
Right. I think that would require an act of Congress.
Right.
Congress would have to say all bank accounts, whatever their size, are fully insured.
So I should remind everybody before that this is, we're talking on Friday.
Yes. Who knows what's going to happen between now and Sunday?
Yes, exactly.
It's a moving
when
target.
We drop. So you're only responsible till Friday at what time is it?
10:37.
10:37 Eastern. So anything
if I make
you
any
say
mistakes,
now, if something happens at 10:38 that we don't know about, Catherine is held harmless here,
like the depositors. That's my bailout.
Right.
So I think that to explicitly say everybody's guaranteed no matter what, that would require an act of Congress. And probably they'd want to do a bunch of other things too, like change how the FDIC insurance program is funded. Because right now it's an insurance plan, right? And you're basically only paying insurance fees on up to $250,000. But if you're actually going to potentially give payouts to any size bank account, probably you should assess those fees on the entirety of people's deposits. You know, that would probably require an act of Congress. The administration has come very close to saying, look, if things get really bad, we will take these votes again. These votes being that, like, we think that there's a systemic risk to the financial system and we are going to bail out these depositors. But they can't make a blanket statement saying, no matter what, if your money is at a community bank, we will protect it, you know, down to the last cent. Because again, the law says they have to have a special vote.
And the vote is of the Fed board.
They need, I think, a 2/3 majority of the Fed board and a 2/3 majority of the FDIC and the support of the Treasury Secretary. This past weekend, you know, it was interesting. I spoke with a bunch of financial experts, financial stability people before this bailout was announced. And a bunch of them said, yeah, I don't think this is going to be rise to the level of a systemic risk. And then, of course, they voted otherwise. and in fact, they voted unanimously. Like I said, they need a 2/3 vote of those two agencies plus the Treasury Secretary. And everyone said, we think we should do this. We think that there is a systemic threat.
Can we talk about how this is different from 08?
Yep.
Please talk to that and why this shouldn't be as scary as that was, but why we're seeing this kind of panic.
So banks in general are in a much healthier financial situation than was the case before the so-called Great Financial Crisis, 2007.
And isn't that partly because Silicon Valley Bank was invested in actually something that was secure, which were treasuries? They just didn't understand that we'd have all this inflation and the treasuries would be worth less and less. And before, in 08, it was like in all these mortgage-backed securities, very sleazy packages, right?
So to be clear, there's a lot of confusion about this. Silicon Valley Bank also invested in long-term mortgage-backed securities, but they were ones that were not like dodgy. So
right.
If interest rates had not gone up, they would have, well, I mean, I guess we don't know what other dumb decisions they might have made, but if interest rates hadn't gone up, this would not have been a problem for them. They bought things that looked safe in the sense that they were not going to result in a default.
What was the inflation rate when they bought these? Do you know?
You know, I don't know. I think a lot of the assets were purchased in late 2021, but I'm not 100% sure. And we were already seeing rising inflation then. I mean, the whole thing is dumb.
It is dumb.
It's so dumb. I spoke with an economist who taught introductory money in banking to business school students at NYU for 10 or 15 years. And I was asking him about this, and he's like, I don't get it. We teach in the first week or the first few weeks of the class that you need to hedge against this particular set of risks. You know, the things that you buy that are long-term, if interest rates move in the wrong direction, you need to have some, you know, they call it a hedge. They, you know, some.
So evidently, the people at Silicon Valley hadn't taken this guy's course.
Apparently not. And in fact, what they did instead, they had hedged against this risk. You know, it's like you buy a little bit of something, and then you buy something else that cuts in the opposite direction, and in case your original bet is wrong. That's basically what a hedge is. They had been hedging against it, and then last year, 2022. So again, this is like, after we have seen
huge inflation,
mm-hmm. after the Fed has explicitly said, hey guys, interest rates have been going up, they will continue going up for some time, Silicon Valley Bank managers said, we're going to dump those hedges because we think interest rates are going down.
Wow.
And again, even if they wanted to make that bet, they should have placed another bet to hedge against it, and they didn't. And this was in their annual financial filings, end of year financial filings in 2022. They said, like, we offloaded all of these hedged investments this year, or we let them lapse, or we sold them, basically. So this was like a risk that was hiding in plain sight. Now, I understand why your typical person may not have been paying attention to it, because most people are not reading the annual financial filings of the 15th or whatever it is, 16th largest bank in America. But the question here is, why didn't the regulators catch it? I think primary blame lies on the managers of the bank. They made dumb decisions.
Explain what regulators do in terms of looking at these kinds of reports. And because they are, that's what these reports are for, the regulators, right?
Well, they're for investors.
Okay.
The annual financial filings that I was talking about, those are public. Those are for investors.
Okay.
But they are obviously available to the bank supervisors, to the regulators as well. And the regulators, in theory, should have privy to non-public information too, if they are doing their job and they're making sure that a bank isn't taking undue risk, isn't doing something that could cause a bigger blow up. I mean, it's not that unusual for banks to fail, to be clear. Little banks fail all the time. We have a ton of banks in the United States, usually not that big of a deal. This was a relatively large bank, and one that, when it went under, you know, could have these huge spillover effects to lots of things outside of the banking sector, because there were a bunch of payroll services companies, for example, that used Silicon Valley Bank. And so the payroll services companies, if they couldn't access their money, that meant that all of the companies that were their clients, their workers couldn't get paid.
So a lot of little people would have been hurt.
Yes, that was the fear. And beyond the spillovers into, you know, these small businesses that would be affected, we've already seen this contagion effect elsewhere in the banking sector, that people said, if this kind of blow up can happen at that bank, maybe that also means it can happen at my bank. And that's basically what we, what you're seeing with a bunch of other mid-sized regional banks this week, seeing outflows of deposits and seeing their stock prices decline.
Oh, boy. So what, between now and Sunday, when this is dropped, what don't you want to see happen?
What don't I want to see happen? It would be really nice if you didn't see another bank failure. And to be clear, there is not like a particular institution that I am worried about. And in fact, the one that I think the most people were concerned about, which was First Republic Bank, just got, as we said at the beginning of this recording, a big cash infusion from their big brothers, essentially, you know, the larger financial institutions. They got a lifeline. And yet their stock price is still falling today. So who knows? But it would be nice if they were, if this were done, if whatever, use whatever euphemism you want to use, panic, anxiety, turmoil, whatever we've seen in the past week, concluded, and then we can move on. Like whatever the issue was, it's settled and we can move on. Because part of the challenge here is, which we haven't really discussed explicitly, is what does the Fed do next, right? Because part of the reason why we've seen these problems at Silicon Valley Bank and some of these other banks is that interest rates have been rising. And that's why their balance sheets suddenly...
Is the Fed going to change its policy about that? I mean, are they going to say, inflation seems to be tamped down a little bit?
Well,
and
inflation is still bad. This is the problem. Mm-hmm. Whatever... The Fed is in a terrible situation because almost whatever it does to solve problem A will make problem B worse, right? And vice versa. Problem A being inflation and problem B being risk of recession, financial market turmoil, et cetera. But we still have really high inflation. It's not as bad as it was in the middle of last year, but it's still like three times as high as the Fed says it is targeting. And the longer we deal with elevated inflation, the harder it can be to stamp out because it becomes sort of self-reinforcing. People have seen prices rise, so they anticipate future price increases and they start raising, you know, if you're a
which
retailer,
is why they want to be aggressive, but being aggressive now is not
right. But if they're too aggressive, then and they break the banks, so to speak, that's not good either. So again, it's like the Fed has this one blunt instrument, which is interest rates, and it has a lot of consequences that they can't exactly control. So the challenge for them is figuring out how do we make sure we are people believe we are committed. We are credibly committed to stamping out inflation without causing a financial crisis or whatever, or tipping us into recession. And that's a really hard thing to figure out. If you look at the forecasts for what the Fed is going to do next week, because they're meeting Tuesday and Wednesday, and they will announce what's going on with interest rates on Wednesday, the forecasts are all over the place.
So are people on the Fed board going like, aha, this is why I'm on the Fed board for a crisis like this. Thank God I'm so glad I'm here. Or are they going like, oi?
I mean, if it were me, I would be saying oi. Because, again, almost whatever choice they make, it will be the wrong choice in some dimension. And
it's comforting.
Yeah, I know. It's hard. Look, they've goofed up a bunch of things, to be clear, in the past few years. I think that they probably should have started raising rates sooner. And the Fed is one of the supervisors, one of the key supervisors for Silicon Valley Bank. So I think that they probably bear some responsibility for not catching this issue sooner. They've screwed up, but they also have almost an impossible task ahead of them, which is how do they balance all of these different risks? You know, how do they deal with inflation and the stability of the financial system, and try not to like cause a recession and cause people to lose their jobs. And it's a really hard set of things to do all at once.
Well, thank you for jumping on again. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And let's hope that by Sunday, when people tune this in, they'll be going like, oh, thank God.
Everything has been fixed.
That's right. Okay.
That's what I'm hoping for. Okay. Thanks, Al.
Well, thanks to Catherine for providing us with that update. And we'll be right back with the interview that we had right before the crash.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s. And each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Catherine was, we were scheduled to do this. You were at home, right? And suddenly someone started a power saw somewhere in your apartment building.
Yes, they decided that was the optimal time to start making really loud construction noises.
Yeah, and so you left.
I left. I sought refuge somewhere else, yes.
At your husband's office, which fortunately is across the street. But he's an economics professor, and you're worried that there may be some students who come for, does he have special times where students can come and ask
questions? No, I think that they just interrupt him constantly, and they will be sorely disappointed to find that I'm here and will be unable to answer whatever complicated econometric questions they have.
Yeah, so he teaches economics, and you write about economics.
Correct. We are a very economics heavy household.
And are you doing well economically?
We're doing okay.
Hey, oh,
we
good,
are doing
good.
Okay as these things go. Yeah.
I don't ever ask my guests that, so I'll get away from that. But I think it's interesting, the two people in economics, and you write great about economics. That's why I'm so thrilled to have you back. I want to ask you. You've written a number of columns lately critical of Biden in one way or another about very specific things. One is about this huge chips thing where we're going to be making microchips, right, in the United States. That was a big accomplishment, right, that bill?
Yes. I think we will have to wait to see how successful it is. But the last few years have definitely shown there is a problem that needs to be resolved, that global supply chains, when they get disrupted, if we don't have some sort of backup resource, some way to get semiconductors, which are a key input into cars, computers, cell phones, you name it, that causes lots and lots of disruptions for other industries. And so it is helpful to have some reliable backup supply. The CHIPS bill is intended to shore up domestic manufacturing of semiconductors in the U.S.
And how does it do that? And what percentage of these chips did we have being made in the United States? How many were made abroad? Where were they made abroad? In China, a lot. And tell us, give us, just for me and my listeners, a little bit broader view of that.
So President Biden likes to talk about how this technology was invented, or at least important steps of it were invented in the United States. Most of that kind of production has shifted abroad. We source a lot from Taiwan, from China, from Japan, from South Korea, from a bunch of other places. And it's not like any one component comes exclusively necessarily from one place. Like it might get different steps in the process may take place in different countries.
So to make one microchip, it might go through a few countries?
Yeah, depending on where the materials are sourced from, for example, or how advanced the ultimate product is. This is not unusual.
It's amazing when we think about how global the global economy is, and how any one machine that you see, how many different places it was made, the elements of it were made. It's amazing, isn't it?
It is. It's almost magical, I think, when you think about the journeys that everyday products have taken around the world to get to you. Something as simple as a microchip or a piece of fruit, for that matter, things that are a little bit less technologically sophisticated. But in the case of chips, the real, national security / economic security concern is that China is a key part of the supply chain. And China and the U.S. have had increasingly adversarial relations. We don't really want to be in a situation, right, where we're on the hook because of some major policy decision that China makes that may not be in our interest.
Right. And even if that hadn't happened, this adversarial relationship, you still don't want that dependence, because an adversarial relationship could develop with the second largest economy in the world.
And well, there are a lot of countries that we have friendly relationships with that are industrial bases.
We're not worried about Germany.
Canada. You're right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I think we shouldn't frame all of this as, everything has to happen in the U.S. because you don't know where your enemies lurk. I think there are plenty of countries where we're happy to have these integrated manufacturing relationships with, and lots of products cross the border back and forth between Canada and the U.S. multiple times. It's like in the auto industry is a good example of this, because it's essentially one economic zone, and that's fine. But China is a slightly different situation. And there is a fear that over the long run, if things worsen, if things deteriorate, not only might there be kind of accidental disruptions in supply chains, which is arguably what happened during COVID, right? But that there might be more strategic ones. And so there is some strategic advantage to building up more of this industrial base in the U.S.
So what did this bill do? Because you said we are yet to see how this is going to work out, how successful this is going to be, and some of the barriers. You wrote a column saying, because President Biden wanted to pair childcare with all these factories, which you kind of pointed out, maybe it's not. We like childcare.
Look, I'm a big fan of expanding childcare. I think that is a huge hole in the current U.S. social safety net. We do not have enough childcare.
Yeah.
This was something else that became especially salient during COVID, but obviously was a problem pre-COVID as well. I'm not knocking efforts to invest in childcare.
Well, I'm for universal pre-K. I'm for, expanding childcare. In Europe, they spend like $7,000 a child to parents. They give them $7,000 a year for each child for their childcare.
Yeah, so that's not how this would work. My beef with My beef with the way that this whole chips and childcare bundle thing has been designed is essentially the federal government has said, if you want to get a big chunk of money from this chips bill, and the chips bill would, I think, invest something like $52 billion total in subsidies for domestic semiconductors. If you want a relatively big piece of that, a big grant, you have to guarantee childcare for generally on-site childcare for your manufacturing workers and the construction workers who build your factory, which sounds nice. Again, like
sounds great.
Sounds great. I love the idea of more people having access to childcare. I think this is a terrible way to do it because because like the money should be used for building the semiconductor industry as efficiently, as quickly as possible. That's the goal. The more conditions you put on who can get this money that are not related to how well they can actually build the plant, I think the less optimized, the less likely it is that the money is going to get used for the thing you want. It's like you're sort of trying to siphon off some of this money for childcare. That's kind of part one. I think you end up with a worse semiconductor program. Part two is I think you also end up with a worse childcare program, in the sense that even if, like, I don't think requiring a bunch of construction companies to offer on-site childcare is going to be the template that solves America's childcare crisis, you know, 10 years from now. I don't think we're going to look back in time and be like, wow, that was the moment when they had those construction firms in Ohio have childcare.
This is you looking at a very specific pairing of two priorities that just probably are a bad idea.
Well, they're a good idea independently,
that's,
right?
That's what I'm saying. But he was trying to kill two birds, and this wasn't the right pond.
It's a turducken, speaking of birds. It's a turducken. It's like we want to cram as many things into the one pot of money.
That we passed.
that we actually got through. Go us, you know, go Congress. But you end up like... In the turducken analogy, you know, you would probably cook the turkey at a different temperature than you would cook the chicken or the duck. But now, like, everything has to be cooked at the same temperature, and you end up with, like, a somewhat less...
That's John Madden's thing where he put a turkey and a chicken and a duck and cooked them together for Thanksgiving.
Yes, for those unfamiliar. But I think this is a really common thing in U.S. policymaking because it's so hard for us to get anything through Congress or otherwise. We try to like stick as much stuff onto the one vehicle that can get through.
But this wasn't in the bill.
This was not actually in the bill. No, this was added by the Department of Commerce.
Yeah, this wasn't like a Christmas tree bill. This was...
No.
Where, okay, let's put, you know, childcare under it.
But it's the same impulse, I think, which is like, because we can't get a real childcare program through, this is the next best thing. We'll make some random construction contractors provide on-site childcare, and that will somehow solve the problem. But what I was going to say was not only do I think that you end up with, you know, the money spent less efficiently, less effectively in building up the semiconductor industry. Also, I think it's a terrible model for childcare. Like we've already seen how problematic it is to have health insurance benefits linked to a specific employer-employee relationship, right? I mean, like you end up with job lock. People are afraid to leave their jobs. You kind of want the option of these benefits available outside of a particular job, you know, a particular employer-employee contract. Even if this childcare model is successful, it is replicating that. It is like recreating all the same problems that we've had from employer-sponsored health insurance, some of which were kind of resolved through Obamacare.
But because of Obamacare, if you lose your job, you can still get healthcare on the exchange.
Right. And this model, I think, is the wrong approach. You're recreating the same pre-Obamacare problems.
So let's move from that, because this is, to me, not atypical of your columns, which is looking at a problem like this. And that's what I really like them. But I want to get into your more general theory of economics. Last time I had you on, I said something out of context a little bit. I said, we all do better when we all do better, which is what Paul Wellstone used to say. We all do better when we all do better. And I think you heard me say, a rising tide lifts all boats. I think you took it that way. What Paul meant, you know, I'm from Minnesota, and so this is a big deal in Minnesota. We all do better when we all do better. He means that we build from the middle class out, basically. And that when the middle class is strong, when working people are strong, that's when the economy does well. And that when a bridge collapses, a Mercedes falls as fast as a Hyundai. That we all do better when we all do better means that we build this society from not the bottom up, but the middle out. That's when America was strongest, when we had a strong middle class. And you write about taxes. You know that we have very, 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 very wealthy people in this country who don't pay taxes. Our country now is much, much more unequal than it was when I was growing up. That's kind of what he meant.
That makes sense. That makes sense. And I think I generally agree with that philosophy, that more economic equality is generally better. I think I care more about setting a floor on living standards than setting a ceiling on it, if that makes sense. So like There are people, do you know what I mean? Like, there are people who think the existence of billionaires is in and of itself a policy mistake. And it's like, I don't care if there are really rich people in the world, they can do whatever they want. What I care more about is how are the least fortunate among us living?
You want universal pre-K. You want early childhood education.
Yes. I'm generally in favor of a much more progressive in the technical sense, safety net and financial redistribution. It's cool if people make a lot of money, but tax them and then use that money to raise the living standards of the people who have less.
Let's talk about how people who make unbelievable amounts of money, you know, multi billionaires, pay no taxes. Let's say someone has $100 billion and it's in like stock, right? Because they own Tesla or something.
As an example.
And they don't pay taxes on holding stock, right?
It depends on how it's structured, but generally, no, you are not, with some exceptions, you are not taxed on the value of your assets. You are taxed on your income for the most part. I'm oversimplifying. You have capital gains and stuff like that, but
you only have capital gains when they're realized.
Right, right.
So he has $100 billion. So now he can borrow money, right? So instead of to live, he can just say, you know what, I want to borrow $500 million. This year to live on. And you know, he's borrowing it, right? And paying interest on it. He doesn't have to pay taxes on that, right?
Generally, no.
So is this how people, because you read about a lot of billionaires not paying any income taxes. And is that how it works?
Right. They can borrow against their assets.
Right.
Which they're not paying income taxes on. The loans that they get to sort of support their lifestyles, there are also not counted as income, so they're not paying taxes on those. To the outside observer, it would look like they are living the life of someone who has a lot of income, but the tax code does not treat them as making income, and so therefore they are not due taxes until they die. And sometimes not even that, right?
Right. Let me ask you, is this common? Is what I'm describing, because I try to get through my head, how is it that people can be this wealthy and pay no taxes, none, zero, or, you know, no income taxes? Is this common?
To the extent that billionaires are common, and they're not that common, or 100 millionaires or what have you, yes, I think this is a fairly easy loophole in the tax code to take advantage of. These people are not breaking any laws. To be clear, this is tax avoidance, not tax evasion. This is, unfortunately, our tax code working as it is designed to do. This is how we have written the law. As long as Congress keeps the law as it is, these people will be on the right side of the law, you know, these very wealthy people.
And do you get the sense, and remember, I was in the Senate, I wasn't on the Finance Committee, so I didn't see this very close hand. But I think we all get the sense that the very wealthy have influence in Congress and that things are written into the tax code that help them all the time.
Yes, I think that is undeniably true. I would argue that there are things written into the tax code that unfairly benefit lots of people besides just the Elon Musks of the world. There are a lot of things in the tax code that are probably also not a, you know, great stewardship of resources and are subsidized things we don't like or give money to people that probably don't need it. So this is not unique.
Can you give me some examples of those?
If you want something like particularly galling, I would talk about the carried interest, which is basically people who work
private equity,
some hedge funds and VC partners. They are effectively taxed at a much lower rate on what, again, to most of us would look like earnings, labor income, but they don't have to call it labor income. So they get taxed at the rate for capital gains, essentially.
And in order to do that, they have to get this money within a certain period. Is that right?
Yeah, there are some constraints on it, but they're really not that onerous. So this is why you have very wealthy private equity people who are, again, on the right side of the law, able to pay much lower tax rates than a nurse, you know, as a percentage of their income, than a nurse or a firefighter or a bus driver or, you know, insert name of working class occupation, I guess.
And they're on the right side of the law because...
because that's how the law is written. That,
and
yeah,
the law is written that way because these people give lots of money sometimes to people who are writing the laws.
That is certainly part of it. And you would know better than I do what those pressures are like as an elected official to not tick off your donors.
I mean, again, I was not on finance, so maybe I didn't feel that at all. But, you know, I'm a progressive. We all do better when we all do better. I think our tax code is completely fucked up. And that,
that's the technical term for it. Yep.
Yeah. What percentage of stocks do like the top 1% of Americans own?
I don't know off the top of my head, but it is definitely disproportional to their to how many of them are in the population. It is more than 1%. I'll put it that way.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
If you're constantly on the hunt for a good deal, then you need Rakuten. Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop because members get cash back at over 3,500 stores across every category, including fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, traveling, dining, and more. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while you're doing it? It's a no-brainer. Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million members who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Your cash back really adds up.
We're back with Catherine Rampell. Let's go to the Inflation Reduction Act and the IRS, the part of the about the IRS. And what was the increase in funding for that?
So the Inflation Reduction Act did a bunch of different things. I think most people know it for the investment in climate,
which is about $390 billion or something.
The biggest climate investment in U.S. history.
Thank God. And could and should be more, but thank God for that. Mm-hmm. What a great achievement. Good.
So it did climate. It did some healthcare stuff. And then it also invested $80 billion in the IRS.
Yes. Yeah, so let's talk about the $80 billion in the IRS.
Yeah, about half of the money, a little more than half, is for enforcement. And what that means is just making sure people are abiding by the law. Like we were just talking about all of these ways that people can legally keep their taxes down, right? But there's plenty of tax cheating, much of which is also done by very wealthy individuals, not exclusively.
But it's harder to catch them because
right,
it's more the way they cheat and to audit them is much more difficult, more complicated.
Right. And there's also some gray area, like some parts of the law, you know, it's not exactly clear how much you owe or how much you don't, like where you are taking an aggressive stance, let's say, in your how you're interpreting the law. If you're a rich person, you have armies of accountants and tax attorneys who can make some of these cases like, well, you can really deduct that or that doesn't really count as income or whatever. And the IRS is so overwhelmed that they're kind of not going to be able to check your work. That's what an audit is, essentially.
Well, so overwhelmed is part of the reason for the $80 billion is
right,
to get auditors that are capable of looking at the people. They don't have armies. You don't need an army of accountants.
No. Well, I say army. Yeah, it's funny. I guess I should be careful about how I, what analogy I use because people literally think that the IRS is a bunch of, you know, armed with machine guns.
Nor do they think that they're the, you know, accountants that they have, that the rich people have weapons. What you're talking about is some of the messaging coming out of Republicans is saying
Ted Cruz, et cetera.
Yeah, that they're going to arm 80,000.
Yeah, so that's not true. What has happened?
IRS people.
What has happened is that the IRS was basically gutted starting around shortly after the Tea Party Revolution, 2010, thereabouts. Funding for the IRS was slashed and slashed and slashed.
And why was that? Purposeful.
Yes, it was a combination of sort of ideological opposition to the government entity that collects revenue, right? If you're one of these Freedom Caucus, Tea Party, whatever you want to call that, you know, the evolving name of that group, you want small government and just, what's the analogy about strangle the baby in the bathtub?
Yeah, yeah. You want to reduce the size of the government so that drown it in a bathtub.
If you, there are all these analogies. If you starve the beast by getting it less tax revenue, then it'll be easy enough to drown in the bathtub. I don't know, a bunch of mixed metaphors. In any event, so part of it was that there was this scandal kind of thing over whether the IRS was auditing at higher rates some right-wing groups
that had the word Tea Party in it or something.
Yeah,
like that.
I think it was like if they had Patriot or something like that.
And was that actually true or not?
I mean, yes and no. I think from my recollection, it's been a while since I covered this, but my recollection was that this wasn't about targeting your political enemies. It was about these are groups that generally do not believe in government, right? And so maybe there's a reason why if you have this keyword in your name, you might be more likely to shirk on your taxes.
Well, they weren't really a 501c4.
Right,
they were a
501c3. Right. These were political organizations, and the tax-exempt groups are generally not supposed to engage in lobbying and political activity. But it was a really clumsy way to go about it. My point is I don't think that there was something malicious here. It was badly handled, and it looked really terrible, and the effects may have not been good in terms of who was affected by these higher audit rates. But that fed this backlash. I mean, everybody's always hated the IRS, right?
No.
Think about the Beatles' Taxman song, you know? I feel like it's not exactly controversial.
It's the one fucking Beatles song that right-wing talk show, you know, talk radio guys play. That's it.
I guess.
That's it.
I think it is not unusual. I think there's a trope in movies, you know, everybody hates it when the tax man shows up, the IRS auditor, agent, whatever.
I will look this up, but I think that people actually want the IRS to do a good job. I think people comply with the IRS. They're fine with paying their taxes. And I think most people don't have that complicated a tax issue. And they're fine. And they don't really hate them at all. And I think what happened here was, it might have been people who didn't trust the government, who were Tea Party people, who think the government is evil. I think mainly who the people behind this were the people that were wealthy people who didn't want to pay taxes and who wanted to avoid paying taxes, who were cheating. And what they wanted to do is gut the IRS so that the IRS could do its job, and especially the job of auditing people who make a lot of money. And doing an effective job of that.
I think it's a combination of things. I think there are people who see it as in their interest to have a much weaker IRS so that they can get away with whatever shenanigans they're getting away with the help of their accountants or otherwise.
Well, first of all, there are legal ways to do that.
That's my point. Yes. Our tax code sucks.
Yeah. So let's put it in a couple categories. The legal way of avoiding paying taxes, that's just avoidance, right?
Yes, that's avoidance.
Okay. There's so many legal ways to do it. The cheating part is very different. And you're able to cheat if there aren't auditors in the IRS who are sophisticated enough to go after people who make over $400,000 or something like that, who cheat.
Yes. And there are certain kinds of tax returns that are much more complicated. You know, if you are a regular W-2 employee, As most workers are, you work for one company generally, you're on their payroll. All of your income is already getting reported to the government anyway. It's easy to check. It's hard to cheat because the government knows. People who have much more complicated, you know, they run their own business. They run businesses in, let's say, industries like real estate that have a lot of complexity in their part of the tax code that applies to them. Much easier to, if not outright cheat, to again, take aggressive tax stances and hope that you just never get caught, that nobody calls you on it.
And the fact is that those people are audited far, far less because it's complicated and because the IRS does not have enough auditors to do that.
There's a little bit of a misconception about this. High income people are still generally audited at higher rates than the typical person, but they're audited a lot less frequently than they used to be. So if you are a millionaire, you still have a higher chance of getting audited than a typical middle-class person, but your chances of getting audited are still pretty low.
I understand there's a very high percentage of people get the earned income tax credit that are
Yes, they have very high audit rates. That's true. Not as high as millionaires, but still high. But that's partly because they're just like low-hanging fruit. These are very easy tax returns to audit. A lot of it's kind of automated.
That's right. That's automated.
Right. They send out a letter saying something doesn't match. You know, two people claimed the same child or whatever as their dependent. Yoink, we're taking back your EITC. That's very, very simple. If you're auditing someone like Donald Trump and you have to sort through like hundreds.
That's impossible. They've discovered.
Right. And it's a lot more resource intensive. It's a lot more complicated. You need much more specialized knowledge to know how to like what to search for, where the bodies might be buried, you know, in the tax return. That's the kind of talent in particular that the IRS lost over the last decade or so was the technical expertise heavy jobs.
Now let's go to, I mean, have you looked at the scoring the CBO has done on this? Because my understanding, like the Republicans in the House, one of the first votes they took was to get rid of the funding for the extra funding for the IRS, which that won't go anywhere.
Yeah, defund the tax police.
Yeah, and you know, as they were saying this is going to be 80,000 armed IRS agents,
which it is not.
There's 200. There are IRS agents who are armed, and they're the ones who are trying to collect money from drug people and from human traffickers. So,
or they're protecting witnesses who are testifying in a trial and things like that. Yeah, there's a very small group of IRS employees who have guns.
And yet Republicans will say,
yes, that they're coming after you.
And they'll say it on Fox. And it turns out they'll say things on Fox that they know aren't true.
What?
Have you been following the news?
I'm just teasing. Yes, I am aware. I'm aware.
My God. No, I've known that for a while, by the way.
You were ahead of the curve.
I was a little bit ahead of the curve, about 20 years. Point is that has CBO scored? And I think they have.
They have. And there's actually, I think there are a lot of people who think that actually CBO understated how much money this investment will bring back, because there are weird rules about like what they're allowed to count as producing revenue. So for example, of the $80 billion, like I said, a little more than half goes to enforcement, and then the rest goes to things like IT upgrades, customer service.
Desperately.
If you have a little time to kill, you can look up this story that I wrote last summer where I visited an IRS facility in Texas where they process the returns, and it is wild. I'm telling you, it is like going through the weirdest Willy Wonka tour, because you're like in this secret factory with the tax returns and, you know, everybody's chaperoning you, and there are just piles and piles of paper everywhere because they use technology from basically the 1970s.
But they've used some of the money from the Inflation Reduction Act to upgrade, and they are now up to speed. in terms of getting people their returns back?
Yes, they have made a lot of progress in going through that
already,
backlog.
Already.
Yes, they have. And they absolutely needed to.
And they have more people answering the phone.
Right. Right. So where I was going with all of this is that when you invest money in the IRS, you get money back, not just because you catch tax cheats who might have been underpaying, but also because the vast majority of people want to pay their taxes accurately. Like you said, people like...
That's what I was saying.
Yes.
I said that.
I agree. Let me finish my point.
Let me finish my point, which was I was right.
You are
right. Most people want to pay their taxes.
Most people are not tax cheats.
And most people don't hate the IRS. They don't.
I don't know. I think they're skeptical at the very least.
I think in fiction, they hate it. When you're right.
Maybe.
If there's a movie, people go, oh, no. But in real life, people go, yeah, I'm going to pay my taxes. And, oh, I get a refund. Or, this year I don't get a refund. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So most people, I think, are honest taxpayers. That's actually truer in the U.S. than in a lot of other countries. We have very high what's called tax morale. There is a term that political scientists try to measure. You know, how good we feel about complying with the tax code, et cetera.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah. Okay. We're better than
Greece. I was saying that.
I still think people are suspicious of the IRS. I don't think those things are mutually exclusive.
You're maybe right.
So
I may be going too far.
People want to pay their taxes.
I still want to be right.
It is so difficult to be compliant, even if you are trying to abide by the law, because the tax law is so damn complicated. If you try to call the IRS, historically, it's gotten better this year. But, you know, in the last 10 years, you try to call the IRS, nobody will answer the phone. If you get a question from the IRS, like they don't understand, you know, they think something's wrong in your tax return, they would send you a physical letter.
Yeah. And this is why they're spending $80 billion.
Yes. So all of which is to say that when you invest money in the IRS, not only will you catch the people who are not trying to abide by the law, you will help the people who are trying their darndest to abide by the law so that they can pay their taxes on time. When you have better customer service, when you have clear answers to basic questions about how you file your taxes, you will have more people compliant. And that raises money too. And figuring out what the dollar value of that is really complicated, like
right.
How much more money comes in as a result. And that's where you get more debate about like what's the return on investment essentially of investing in the IRS. You know, you can make one set of assumptions about catching the tax cheats. You can make another set of assumptions about, well, what about all the people who were law abiding before, but like were making dumb mistakes because they couldn't get anyone on the phone? How much more money are we going to get from them because we have a more functional system?
That's why it's hard to score it, but there was a score.
Right. There was a score. It probably understated the value, to be honest.
But it was like $120 billion.
Yes. It was a huge amount of money.
Yeah. This is $120 billion out of probably the, you know, close to $1 trillion that should be paid that aren't paid. And that's $120 billion above the spending the $80 billion, right?
Yes. That's the net, right?
That's the net.
After you strike out all the money you spend, that's how much more you get on net coming into the Treasury.
Okay. So the Republicans in the House, basically, with that vote, would have increased the deficit by $120 billion.
Correct.
Okay. So this brings me to the debt ceiling. So they're voting there, and you've written on a couple of things where there's a Trump tax cut that is expiring, and no one is going to vote to let it expire. You've written about this a couple of times, right?
So there are a few different things. I think what you're talking about is the Trump tax cuts, most of the tax cuts for individuals rather than corporations expire in 2025.
Right.
That's what you mean? Yeah.
I've read a column of yours maybe a while ago. So
Yeah. So that is true. The way that it was sneaky, the way that Republicans passed this tax law, it was very expensive, even as CBO scored it, but it looked not even as expensive as it actually is, because Republicans are assuming that, or they wrote into the law, all of these tax cuts, at least on the individual side, expire. And so therefore we get more money coming in, you know, several years to the future, with the expectation that no one would have the guts to actually let the tax cuts expire, because once you give people something, it's very hard to take it away.
Do you know what these tax cuts are, where they're located?
It's a bunch of different things. It's like the doubling of the standard deduction. It's, I think, the rates revert to going back to where they were. It's almost everything on the individual side. So most Americans did get a tax cut from the Trump tax bill. The richest people got the biggest tax cuts, but almost everyone else got at least a little bit chopped off of their taxes. And so that will all revert. And it's interesting. It's like at the time, Democrats were uniformly opposed to all of these tax cuts.
To the whole thing. The whole package. Which was going to increase the deficit by, what, $1.9 trillion?
Yeah, I think the final number before COVID was about $1.8 trillion. I don't know what the numbers would look like now, because that, you know, the economy changed. But
yeah, I mean, everything went kablooey.
Democrats were against those tax cuts when they were passed, but I think it is very unlikely that they will.
I voted against it.
I think that when this stuff expires, they will be reluctant to let the tax cuts that they opposed before, I think they will vote to keep them in place.
That Democrats opposed before.
Yes, I think that's what's likely to happen, at least for most of them. Because again, almost everybody benefited at least a little, and Republicans will frame it as Democrats want to raise your taxes.
Well, they frame it as this is the one part of the tax cut that helped you.
Right. Well, it was still expensive. Still expensive, and probably there are better ways to use that money rather than, you know, just throwing a lot of cash back at people.
Stuart Stevens wrote this book called it. You know, Stuart was campaign manager for W, mm-hmm. and I think a main campaign figure for Romney, and he's part of the Lincoln Project. But he wrote a book called "It Was All a Lie," and all this Republican stuff about, you know, we want low deficits was just a complete lie.
And absolutely, yeah.
And all their tax cuts were aimed to help people at the top.
Like I said, there were benefits for people in the middle class and at the bottom, just not nearly as big as those at
the
top.
But I remember, because I wrote about this in Lies and Lying Liars, George W., in his first debate with Gore, said, "By far, the vast majority of my tax cuts goes to those at the bottom. By far, the vast majority."
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was wrong.
It was amazingly wrong. I mean, it was spectacularly wrong. But if you think, how much is vast? That's like space, right? Vast. So by far, the vast majority is more than half, right? So
yes,
more than half your tax.
Generally, in the English language, that is the understood definition.
But a vast majority
is
like a galaxy, a universe. That's vast, vast reaches of space. And then by far a vast majority. And it was a complete lie. And yet the headline from that debate, I remember, was Gore had said that he had gone to a disaster with James Lee Witt. He went to a flood, but it wasn't. He had gone to a fire. And the press reported that was the big lie in the debate.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, but this is, to me, is as we're heading toward the debt limit, which is very scary, right? This is like the scariest thing ever, maybe.
Yes, I'm very worried about this.
Like, we're approaching the scariest thing that's ever happened economically in our history, a moment where if we default on our debt, what happens?
A lot of bad stuff. So to lay out some of the consequences in no particular order, technically we violate the Constitution, because the Constitution says that the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned. So, you know, no biggie, whatever. Violate the Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, so what? We've done that before. We tortured people.
That's true. Not unprecedented, I guess. Beyond that, you know, you potentially have a global financial crisis because...
Well, there's that.
Yeah, because U.S. debt is currently considered the safest of safe places to keep your money.
The dollar is the default currency.
The reserve currency, yep.
What does that mean? It's the reserve currency.
It's like the basis on which lots of other transactions are benchmarked or calculated, I guess is one way.
Yeah, they would rather do that than on, say, the ruble.
Yes, it's a good store of value. You believe that the U.S. government will pay back its debts because we always have. And unlike lots of other countries that are, you know, fiscal basket cases where they default on their debt, et cetera, we don't. We are reliable borrowers. We're a rich country. We have the resources.
We have never, ever, ever, ever defaulted on our debt. We came very close in 11.
Yes.
Very close.
So as a result of that, because U.S. debt is considered so safe and everything else is benchmarked against it, like how much riskier is this other thing, whether it's a mortgage-backed security or a different currency or anything else, you know, some corporate debt, how everything is compared against.
Mortgage-backed security sound really secure.
Whatever. I'm just, no. Well, this is, depends what they are. Yeah. Separate issue. Yeah. Sorry, that was a distraction. The point is that if we are revealed to be risky when people thought we weren't, that sets off kind of like a chain reaction in all of these other markets where you could see panic. Like in a similar way that you saw financial contagion when we had a banking crisis. You know, it's not identical, but like to give you a sense.
Started
of,
the Great Recession.
Yes, exactly.
That was pretty bad, the Great Recession. It was called the Great Recession.
Yes, it was great, but in a bad way.
That's right.
So
good point.
So so you could have, you know, these kind of shockwaves of financial panic. We don't know exactly what that would look like, but it could be quite bad. Beyond that, in the long run, it actually makes our debt problems worse.
Of course, of course.
Right now, because we are considered a really reliable, safe borrower, other people and countries and companies are willing to lend us money at really low interest rates.
Yep.
And if we look like we're kind of kooky or unreliable, then lenders will demand higher rates, which means we have to pay more in interest over the long run, which means our debt goes up.
That's why Marjorie Taylor Greene should be the Republican spokesman when we do go over the debt limit so that we don't,
yeah?
So the rest of the world doesn't think of us as kooky.
Yeah, okay.
She should be the one to explain, look, we just, the deficit's too high and we wanted to control this. And so they won't accept our draconian cuts in education and infrastructure. So I'm telling the world, this was part of the deal that McCarthy could become speaker, is that I would be the spokesperson to the world to show them why we're doing this.
Yeah, that'll really calm everyone's nerves right there.
Okay, that was just a little fever dream. Sorry.
I think you and Marjorie Taylor Greene share that fever dream. So unfortunately, I'm sure she would love that job.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's no purpose served by the debt ceiling.
It should automatically go up.
Yeah, it should go up. It should be abolished, or it should be raised to some astronomical number that it's never really that relevant.
I like the $1 trillion coin.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I think it's
a little gimmicky.
You do? You think it's a little gimmicky?
It's a little gimmicky. I don't know. I mean, if you're worried about, again, financial panic, I'm not sure that
the trillion dollar coin is going to settle everything.
Is really going to like... Yeah.
And can you imagine, like, where's the $1 trillion coin? What do you mean, where is it? I gave it to you. No, you didn't.
It's in the couch cushion somewhere.
Come on. I gave it. You're the Treasury Secretary and I'm the president. And I gave it to you. I don't remember you giving it to me. See, that's a problem that I don't think a lot of people are thinking
of
as losing the $1 trillion coin.
They have to make it really big so that it's easier to spot.
Yes.
You know, it's like a dinner plate.
Oh, or
rather
or
than
huge.
The size of a penny.
You know, there's a $1 trillion coin. It could be, could be the size of they could put it in the Capitol on the floor. No, then they take it. Then the there'd be another riot. Okay. It'd be a heist. That would be a good heist movie.
Someday. You should write it.
Okay. I think I got, finally we got something out of this podcast, a good screenplay. we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that, but we're going to, it's possible that we could go over this cliff. And we came very, very close, and the S&P downgraded us, right? Mm-hmm. When that happened in 11. So they vote against increasing the funding for the IRS, which CBO, and you say very conservatively, says cuts the debt by $120 billion, but they vote against it.
Yeah, this whole idea that Republicans are fiscally responsible is, you know, BS. The comparison I've used is that they're like cicadas. Republican fiscal conservatives, it's like they go underground while there's a Republican in the White House.
Oh, I see.
And then they pop up and they're like, oh, we're going to swarm and we're going to demand cuts and fiscal conservatism and all that stuff.
That's exactly right.
But they don't.
And because if you track it, greater debts during like Reagan and Bush 1 and Bush 2.
And Trump, even before COVID, if you look at the amount of debt that Trump signed into law before COVID hit, it's like $4.7 trillion, about half of which is new spending. Only about half of it is tax cuts. Everybody talks about how expensive the tax cuts were, and they were expensive. But Trump also expanded the government through a lot of new spending, including on defense.
Defense, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So it's not like this idea that Republicans are good stewards with your money and they really care about balancing the budget. It's bull. I don't think Democrats particularly care either.
Yeah. And that means that our debt is going to increase. And it just mm-hmm. keeps increasing. And there was this period, again, when Obama became president, then suddenly Republicans cared about the debt.
Yes, the cicadas emerged.
So you had Simpson Bowles. There's Simpson Bowles, and that's what happened the last time. That's what happened in 2011, right? Mm-hmm. They went to the thing and they said, "Nope, we're going to go over the cliff unless you accept the sequester, unless you accept these cuts," right?
Yes, there was a grand bargain or whatever they called it at the time to bring spending down or to curb spending. I'll put it that way.
And that's what they want to do this time. And they want to use.
Yeah, sort of. You know, they sort of want to do that, but they've kind of ruled that out, too, because they've said Republicans have they claim they want to reduce deficits, but they have ruled out like every possible mathematical path to doing it. Right. Well, because they say we can't raise taxes. In fact, we want to cut taxes. You mentioned that one of the first things that they did was that they voted to effectively raise deficits by defunding the IRS.
Right.
Another one of the first things that they did was they introduced a bill to extend the Trump tax cut. So they're not going to do anything on taxes that would solve the problem. They also have now said that they don't want to do anything to Social Security or Medicare.
Which is because they had said they were going to do that. And the president in the State of the Union said, "You're going to do that." And they went, "No, liar."
To be clear, even before that, you know, very memorable moment at the State of the Union, a bunch of Republicans already publicly said, "No, we're not going to do that."
Yeah,
so like,
a bunch
it wasn't
of them.
Clear that they had the votes to do it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but like the guy heading up the Senate campaign committee said that's what we're going to do. And Ron Johnson continues to say it.
I know. They can't all get on the same page.
Yes.
So they've ruled out taxes. They've ruled out entitlements. They've ruled out defense. There are some Republicans who are like, "Oh, let's cut defense." And then a lot of them are like, "Hell no, we're not going to cut defense." They've ruled out veterans. Because if you rule out all of those things and you extend the Trump tax cuts, you basically have to reduce everything else in the budget to close to zero, because that's the bulk of.
You know where we can get some money? The diabetes prevention programs.
Okay.
There's
Says
a good
who?
Place to cut.
or like they're like, "Well, we'll just cut the wokeness programs." And it's like,
no, that's
how much,
a lot
how big of a line
money.
Item is wokeness? Yeah, exactly.
What are the wokeness programs? The wokeness programs are like
the FBI. I think that there's this guy who had been the head of OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, under Trump, Russ Vogt, I think is how you pronounce his name, who now runs some political group that's been trying to sell Republicans on a particular plan for dealing with deficits. And it's all about cutting wokeness out of the budget. And if you look at the plan, it's whatever, 100 pages, very detailed. You know, it has woke 100 times or 80 times or something like that. And the FBI, I think, is one of the categories that is considered woke. I'm trying to remember what else, but it's like everything is woke. Everything that the Republicans are mad about, that's woke. And we're going to cut
it. But what does that mean? You cut the FBI woke program, or you cut
whatever that is. Yeah, I don't know what it means in practice. Look, it's not a serious proposal.
FBI, raise your hand. what is your pronoun?
Yes, exactly. It's all demagoguing. Nobody really has a serious plan for dealing with deficits, which is unfortunate because I do think the country has some long-term problems that need to be resolved and will require some unpopular things, including potentially raising taxes or restructuring benefits. Probably some grown-up needs to figure out what we're going to do, but you know, it's not an imminent disaster. So like, let's just all pretend we have a solution which involves cutting wokeness or something else that is not painful, and never actually resolve it. And to be clear, like, I don't think any of this stuff, like whatever concerns I have about long-term fiscal issues, I think they are completely unrelated to whether or not we should raise the debt limit. Debt limit should be raised without conditions. We do have these other unrelated problems that we should deal with that nobody cares about, apparently, or not seriously enough to come up with a real solution.
My solution? Mm-hmm. Collect taxes that people owe. That's one. And then change our tax code to capture a lot of this money that wealthy and very wealthy people have. And when I say wealthy, I mean people, you know, who are making $500,000 a year and take deductions because they can put money aside for their kids' college, right? Mm-hmm. And they can have that sheltered. And there's all kinds of things that are stuff that we need to kind of look at and say, we got to be good stewards for the future. I'm, you know, not been a deficit hawk at all, but we need to actually collect the taxes that are owed, and we need to change the code to reflect that we have a society that is so top heavy in income that those people need to pay more. Now, that's so fucking easy to say, right?
Much easier said than done, as I'm sure you know.
As I know. Well, thank you, Catherine. This has been... thank you for going to your husband's office. No students came for...
So far, not.
Ask any questions. I would have been happy to answer any.
Oh, yeah. It's too bad. I would have put them on the phone with you. Or the podcast with you. They could ask you about how to prove whatever theorem they're trying to prove. We'll see how that goes.
Well, thank you. This has been fun for me. And I'll keep reading you. And I hope my listeners do check you out in the Washington Post. Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
The early 2000s was a wild time for reality TV. There seemed to be an endless supply of shows that delivered entertainment for us, but trauma for children. I'm Misha Brown, the host of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop. Each week on The Big Flop, comedians join me to chronicle the biggest pop culture fails of all time and try to answer the age-old question, who thought this was a good idea? We recently looked behind the scenes of what was really going on at Abby Lee Miller's dance studio. Abby's biggest misstep wasn't screaming nonsensical catchphrases or throwing chairs on television, but instead, she was choreographing financial fraud in plain sight. Join me to break down all the wild details of Abby Lee Miller's story. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Once upon a beat.
Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think, some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me,
DJ Fu,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the new Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Once Upon a Beat.